don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. Welcome back to the Cryptoconomy Podcast. Got a quick read today from Stop and Decrypt. If you're not following this individual on Twitter, I definitely suggest it. They got a lot of interesting stuff, and he just released, May 23rd, so this was yesterday, an article. I was planning on reading the one by Jameson Lopp that I think is 5 months old now, about the difficulties of maintaining Ethereum infrastructure. But this one just came out, which is essentially on the exact same topic and kind of hits it from a slightly different perspective, which I think is a really, really good breakdown here that I just finished reading. So it's titled, "The Ethereum Blockchain Size Has Exceeded 1 Terabyte." And yes, it's an issue. One quick note, there are a lot of graphics, screenshots to Twitter posts and GitHub posts, as well as charts, and I will do my best to explain them quickly to give context to the conversation that follows. So without further ado, let's go ahead and jump in. Too long didn't read? It has nothing to do with storage space limits. This is an indirect response to the following article by Afri Shodan, a developer for the Parity Ethereum client, written less than a year ago. It's titled, "The Ethereum Blockchain Size Will Not Exceed 1 Terabyte Anytime Soon." I want to make it clear that I have respect for almost all of the developers in this space, and this is not intended to attack anyone. It's meant to elaborate on what the real concerns are and explain how the original article does nothing to address those real concerns. I would actually love to see something that does, because then we can throw it into Bitcoin. That being said, there are some developers who mislead, obscure, ignore, and attack via protocol confusion, like what occurred with 2x and the replay protection drama. But most aren't like that. You can't watch something like this or read something like this and hate these developers. They're genuinely trying to fight the same fight as us, and I believe Afri is part of the latter group, not the former. So the two links there that he referenced were first a YouTube video of a Ethereum community conference with Ashley Tyson, Josh Stark, Robbie Bent, and Sina Habibian. I hope I said that right. And then the other is a tweet by Ashley Tyson that says, quote, "New York City Blockchain Week was the most egregious and depressing display of bullshit and charlatanry I've ever seen. The worst of Wall Street and tech socialites wanting to gain relevance and power in a space designed to fundamentally dismantle the power dynamics they created," end quote. She's got a thread essentially underneath this, and this conversation goes on with Elizabeth Stark and a number of other things. So if you want to dig a little bit deeper into that, but that top tweet basically sums up the position and gets the point across that Stop and Decrypt is trying to make here, is that these people are honest and they're trying to build something real. If you've read my other articles, you're going to see some small bits of that information repeated. Up until now, I wrote primarily about Bitcoin from a, quote, maximalist perspective. Still am. And focused on conflicts within that community. What you may find interesting, if you only watch from the corner of your eye, is that the reason for, quote, conflict here is exactly the same. I'll even use proof of stake as further leverage for my argument without criticizing it. Edit. It seems like people are not reading the subtitle and misunderstanding something. This is not about archival nodes. This is about fully validating nodes. I don't care if you prune the history or skip the line to catch up with everyone else. This is about staying in sync after the fact. Light nodes are not nodes. Index. My argument. Ethereum's runaway data directory size is just the tip. My prediction. It will all work until it doesn't. My suggestion. Transpose. My argument. Larger blocks centralize validators. It's that simple. It's the central argument in the entire cryptocurrency community in regards to scaling. Not many people familiar with blockchain protocol actually deny this. The following is an excerpt from what I consider to be a very well put together explanation of various layer 2 scaling options, of which the only working one is already implemented on Bitcoin. Quote, the scaling challenges of public blockchains. First, it's important to understand that scaling isn't a single specific problem. It refers to a collection of challenges that must be overcome to make Ethereum useful to a global user base of billions of people. The most commonly discussed scaling challenge is transaction throughput. Currently, Ethereum can process roughly 15 transactions per second, while in comparison, Visa processes approximately 45,000 per second. In the last year, some applications like CryptoKitties or the occasional ICO have been popular enough to slow down the network and raise gas prices. The core limitation is that public blockchains like Ethereum require every transaction to be processed by every single node in the network. Every operation that takes place on the Ethereum blockchain, a payment, the birth of a CryptoKitty, deployment of a new ERC-20 contract, must be performed by every single node in the network in parallel. This is by design. It's part of what makes public blockchains authoritative. Nodes don't have to rely on someone else to tell them what the current state of the blockchain is. They figure it out for themselves. This puts a fundamental limit on Ethereum's transaction throughput. It cannot be higher than what we are willing to require from an individual node. End quote. And that was from an article by Josh Stark, who was actually in the video referenced earlier of Ethereum Conference. He was one of the four speakers. And it is titled, Making Sense of Ethereum's Layer 2 Scaling Solutions, State Channels, Plasma, and TrueBit. That article is written by Josh Stark. He gets it. His company even announced a project that's meant to mirror the Lightning Network on Ethereum, which is oddly coincidental given that Elizabeth Stark's company is helping build Lightning. The problem? Putting everything about proof of stake completely to the side, the incentive structure of the base layer is completely broken because there is no cap on Ethereum's block size. And even if one was put in place, it would have to be reasonable. And then these dApps wouldn't even work, because they're barely working now with no cap. It doesn't even matter what the cap is set at for this argument to hold, because right now, there is none in place. So let's backtrack a bit. I'm going to briefly define a blockchain and upset people. Here is what a blockchain provides. An immutable and decentralized ledger. That's it. Here's what a blockchain needs to keep these properties. A decentralized network with the following prerogatives. Distribute my ledger, or validate. Append my ledger, the work. And incentivize my needs, the token. Here is what kills a blockchain. Any feature built into the blockchain that detracts from the network's goals. A blockchain is just a tool for a network. It's actually a very specific tool that can only be used by a very specific kind of network. so much so that they require each other to exist and fall apart when they don't cooperate, given enough time. You can build on top of this network, but quite frankly, anything else built into the base layer, or layer one, that negatively affects the network's ability to do its job is going to bring the entire network to its knees, given enough time. Here's an example of a layer one feature that doesn't affect the network, multisig. It does require the node to do a bit of extra work, but it's marginal. The important thing to note is hardware is not the bottleneck for these, properly designed, networks. Network latency is. Something as simple as paying to a multi-signature address won't tax the network any more than paying to a normal address does, because you're paying on a per-byte basis for every transaction. It's a blockchain feature that doesn't harm the network's ability to continue doing its job, because the data being sent over the network is, one, paid for per byte, and two, regulated via the block size cap. Regulated, not, quote, artificially capped. The block size doesn't restrict transaction flow. It regulates the amount of broadcast to all data being sent over the network. And herein lies the problem. When we talk about the data directory size, it's a direct reference to the size of the entire chain of blocks from the original Genesis block. But taking this at face value results in the standard responses. 1. Disk space is cheap. Also see Moore's Law. 2. You can prune the blockchain if you need to anyway. 3. You don't need to validate everything from the Genesis block. The last X amount of blocks is enough to trust the state of the network. What these completely ignore is the data per second a node must process. You can read my entire article about Moore's Law if you want, but I'll excerpt the important part below. Over in Oz, they try to argue, quote, you don't need to run a node, only miners should decide what code is run, end quote. It's borderline absurd, but I won't have to worry about that here because proof of stake completely removes miners and puts everything on the nodes. They always were, but now there aren't miners to divert the argument. 1. Moore's Law is a measure of integrated circuit growth rates, which averages to 60% annually. It's not a measure of the average available bandwidth, which is more important. 2. Bandwidth growth rates are slower. Check out Nielsen's Law, starting with a 1-to-1 ratio. No bottleneck between hardware and bandwidth. At 50% growth annually, 10 years of compound growth results in a 1-to-2 ratio. This means bandwidth scales twice as slow in 10 years, 4 times slower in 20 years, 8 times in 40 years, and so on. It actually compounds much worse than this, but I'm keeping it simple and it still looks really bad. 3. Network latency scales slower than bandwidth. This means that as the average bandwidth speeds increase among nodes on the network, block and data propagation speeds do not scale at the same rate. And 4, larger blocks demand better data propagation, or latency, to counter node centralization. Strictly from an Ethereum perspective, with a future network of just nodes after the switch to proof of stake, you generally want to ensure node centralization is not an issue. The bottleneck for Bitcoin's network is its block size, as it should be, because it ensures the growth rate of network demands never exceed the growth rate of external, and in some cases indeterminable, limitations like computational performance or network performance. Because of Ethereum's exponentially growing block size, the bottleneck is not regulated below these external factors, and as such results in a shrinking and more centralized network due to network demands that increasingly exceed the average user's hardware and bandwidth. So he's got a post here titled, it was a post by him, and it's titled 10 gigabytes in 2 days. As a Bitcoiner, serious question. What are the plans to address this exponential trend? You're about to gain 33% in less than a month. Please be nice. And then we've got Vitalik Buterin's response. That chart is highly misleading. 300 gigabytes is the size of a full archive node, which stores the history, present state, and all historical states. The state itself is only 1 to 2 gigabytes, and the history is approximately 10. A pruned node would still store the full state and history, and so would be able to recompute any historical state if you really needed it. But it would only consume around 20 gigabytes. If you only care about present state, you can go much lower. And Sin Ting responded, "Don't think people worry about space as much as bandwidth. What are bandwidth requirements real-time for network security, like minimum upload speeds for full nodes?" Similar to this analysis, and he's got a link on GitHub, and then another on Twitter. And user PrivPub responds, "Could you respond to the argument that a pruned node is like an SPV node in Bitcoin and does not allow for, quote, true decentralization?" And Vitalik finally writes, "You're thinking of a light client, and even Ethereum light clients have much stronger properties than Bitcoin SPV nodes. Bitcoin SPV nodes can verify transactions. Ethereum light clients can verify present state." Bitcoin SPV clients aren't nodes. They don't propagate blocks or transactions around the network. They leech. And all that they leech are the block headers. Remember this, because it's going to get very important later in this article. You can put invalid transactions into a block and still create a valid block header. If the network is controlled by 10 full nodes, you only need half of them to ignore or approve the invalid transactions so long as the header is valid. This is why validating the transactions matters from a network perspective, and why you need a large decentralized network. It doesn't matter from my grandma's perspective, and that's fine, but we aren't talking about my grandma. We're talking about ensuring the network of working and actively participating nodes grows, not shrinks. This node was participating until it got cut off due to network demand growth. Crypto Ogre on Reddit says, quote, "I don't know what's happened or if Geth now has system requirements. Previously, I was running Geth on Core i3 with 8 gigabytes of RAM and was able to do fast syncs in under 2 hours with cache of 1024. Once the attacks happened, I was unable to sync or run Geth. Now, after the fork, Geth stops syncing at around 99% after maybe 6 hours and starts normal block imports, cannot catch up, and I continuously at 5 hours to 7 hours behind the chain. I'm going to test on cloud VM with SSD drives, but the only thing I can think of is Geth requirements are now outside of my machine's capabilities," end quote. User IamSunbird responds, "This is also my problem. Client has been syncing for 1.5 days, still out of date." It's not uncommon, and it continues to happen. These are posts on GitHub. Sonal RK commented on July 17th, 2017. "What I could understand from this Geth fast mode problem is that, one, you must use quad-core processor with 4 gigs or more of RAM. 2, you must use SSD instead of HDD. 3, your internet connection must be at least 2 megabytes per second or more and reliable. If all above are checked, then you should try Geth. Using Geth in full mode, you would most probably sync in a week or two max. In fast mode, it depends on your luck, but you are most probably synced in 2 to 3 days or never." Wins Vega commented on January 4th of 2018, "Geth 1.8, still having this issue. After reboot, Geth shows this error. Warning, ancestor below allowance. Warning, synchronization failed dropping peer. Now fast sync is dropping peers and not syncing. Approximately 100 blocks to finish, but it never gets synced." CCLotto310 commented on January 4th, 2018 as well, "This is the nature of P2P networking. You're at the mercy of the peers and network condition. Usually, when you wait enough, it would work. Control C and restart is fine too, which hopefully can get you a better peer. Another alternative is to find a good peer and add it manually. And this is on the github.com/Ethereum and Go Ethereum under the issues. Notice how the solution is to, quote, find a good peer or upgrade your hardware. Good peers shouldn't be the bottleneck. Hardware shouldn't be either. When all of your peers are hosed up by so many others leeching from them because the good peers are the ones doing the real work, you create a network of masters and slaves that gradually tend towards only one master and all slaves. Parenthesis. If you don't agree with that statement, you need to make a case for how this trend will subside in the future, because currently, that's the direction this is going towards, and it won't stop unless a cap is put in place. If your answer is sharding, I address that fairy dust at the end. Close parenthesis. It's the definition of centralizing. Unregulated blocks centralize networks. Large but capped blocks are only marginally better, but set a precedent for an ever-increasing block size, which is equally as bad because it sets a precedent of increasing the size, quote, in times of need, which mirrors the results of unregulated block sizes. This is why we won't budge on the Bitcoin block size. I tweeted about it a few times, but clearly I didn't think that was enough. My Twitter reach doesn't really extend much into the Ethereum space. He's got a Twitter post of a chart that shows the linear growth of the Bitcoin blockchain, represented as a simple multiple 50x function. Then he's got another curve of the node, which is forced to always upgrade, and hardware's exponential growth of Moore's law, which is a simple function of x to the third exponent. And then finally, the demands of Ethereum's network and soon to be Bcash's, which is 2 to the exponent x function, which both the Moore's law and the demands of the Ethereum and or Bcash network start out lower than Bitcoin's linear growth, but then they reach a point where they both start to curve up past it, and the demands of the network eventually exceed the hardware and exponential growth of hardware technology, and once it passes that point, it accelerates out of control. And his tweet, need further clarification? Let's say the volume of data your Geth node needs to process to stay synced is currently 100, quote, units. Your rig can process 150 units. Tomorrow, the network demands 101 units. Next month, it's 125 units. A backlog will eventually occur. This chart is symbolic and not representative of any actual numbers. It only serves to visually express the point I'm trying to make. To clarify, the green curve represents an aggregated average of the various demands of the Ethereum network. At some point, your node will fall out of sync because of this, or a block size cap will be put in place. It could happen now, or it could happen in 10 years, or in 50, but your node will fall out of sync at some point at this rate. It will never happen in Bitcoin. You can deny it now all you want, but this article will be here for when that happens. And when it does, asinine dApps like CryptoKitties, Shrimp Farm, PayPay Farm, and whatever comes next will cease to function. This is exactly what happened to Ryan Charles's service, yours.org, that he originally built on Bitcoin. The only difference being, Bitcoin already had the cap in place, and Ryan either didn't foresee this from a lack of understanding, or for some reason he expected the block size to keep getting raised. Instead of reassessing, he doubled down on Bcash. Meanwhile, Yalls.org took his concept and implemented the same exact thing on top of Bitcoin's Lightning Network. My prediction: Ethereum will implement a block size cap, and it will race Bcash to both of their deaths. And he's got a chart comparing the Ethereum and Bitcoin data directory size in full, which is the full blockchain. And Bitcoin obviously has our clear linear growth with the solid block size cap. And Ethereum towards November or December of 2017 sharply takes an uptick. And as of May 14th, 2018, where it was roughly around 350 gigabytes just 5 months ago, it is now at 1.1 terabytes in size. And the projection, without any reason to think this is going to be capped or stopped in some way, is a steep incline into the future that in possibly just a couple of months could see 1.5, maybe even 2 terabytes towards the end of this year. This chart isn't even a prediction. This is me filling in the blanks in yellow on what was the last remaining graph that compared both chains' data directories and then extrapolating from it. Here's what we know. First, Bitcoin's future is predictable. The blockchain growth and network demands will always be linear. This is ideal. Next, the amount of data an Ethereum node is required to process per second is through the roof and climbing. Unideal. Next, if Ethereum on-chain demand freezes where it is now, blockchain growth will continue the linear trend highlighted by that dotted line. Very bad. Next, if Ethereum on-chain demand continues to grow exponentially, the amount of people complaining about their node going out of sync will reach a tipping point. There's only one option when this occurs. That graph above, the owner stopped trying to maintain the node. Physical demands are an issue as well, like time constraints in your personal life. Servicing requirements need to be low, not high, and not reasonable. Low. Do you know what I do to service my Bitcoin and Lightning node? I leave my laptop on. That's it. If I have to reboot, I shut down the services, reboot, and start them back up again. Day to day, I use my laptop for an assortment of other tasks, none of which inhibit its ability to run the node software. With all due respect, if a change was implemented and forced on me that resulted in my node no longer being compatible with the network and unable to maintain a sync, I would flip out over the idiocy that allowed it, if I was a misinformed individual. Fortunately, I'm not, and I signed up for a blockchain with foresight, Bitcoin. The problem? I don't think most of the people running Ethereum nodes are informed enough to know what they signed up for. I don't think they understand the fundamental incentive models, and I don't think they fully realize where and why they break down with something as simple as not having a block size cap. Hopefully this article will succeed at teaching that. So what happens when that psychological tipping point is reached? Do people give up? How many nodes have to be lost for this to occur? The Explorer websites aren't even tracking this data anymore. Etherscan.io is no longer tracking full or fast sync directories. Etherchain.org says, error, not found. Etherscan also isn't letting you zoom out on the memory pool, the queue of transactions waiting to be included into blocks. The reason fees go up is because this queue builds up. You should be able to see this over time. Here's one that tracks Bitcoin's mempool side by side with the Etherscan.io one. Both of these charts are monitoring the rough total pending transaction counts on these networks, and the scales are about the same, 4 to 5 days respectively. The difference? I can zoom out on the Bitcoin one and see the entire history. Why does this matter? Psychology matters when your network has no regulated upper boundaries. Here's what ours looks like zoomed out. The first chart shows the two mempools side by side and kind of makes it appear as if there's kind of standard fluctuations and if there's not a huge comparison between them. And then the second chart shows the enormous spikes that we've had in the past and how giant the mempool has been. And then as soon as we hit in February of 2018, how it has trickled down to a very small and stable number of transactions. Essentially showing the relationship that the block size regulates the cost of the transaction data and therefore keeps it manageable for the network, whereas Ethereum on this smaller scale, since you cannot see the larger trend, you don't really know if or how the network is regulating the amount of information being put into it, if at all. See what I mean? See how scale matters? What if I zoomed out on Ethereum's mempool and saw that it was at the top of an ever-growing mountain? I'm not saying that's where it is today, but I am saying that this information needs to stop being obscured. I'm also saying that if or when it ever is unobscured, it'll be too late, and nothing can be done about it anyway. It's already too late now. Let's take a look at block and transaction delay on Bitcoin's network. Below, you'll see two charts. The first one is how long it takes for a block to spread across the network. The second is for a transaction. Transactions are processed by the nodes, all 115,000 of them, and held onto until a valid block is created by a miner and announced to the network. Block propagation times have dropped drastically because of very well-designed improvements to the software. Transactions are validated when they come in and kept in the mempool. When a new block is received, it's quickly cross-referenced with all the transactions that you already have stored, and very rarely includes many transactions that you haven't received yet. This allows your node to validate that block extremely fast and send it out to all your other peers. Transaction times, on the other hand, have slowly gone up, but seem to be stabilizing. They've been, quote, intentionally allowed to go up as a result of privacy improvements in the software. But that's a worthy trade-off because blocks are 10 minutes apart on average anyway, so a delay of 16 seconds is acceptable. I'd imagine that once blocks are consistently full, this growth will level off because transaction fees from the block size cap will self-regulate the incoming flow of transactions, assuming no other protocol changes are made. Keep in mind, none of this information is available for Ethereum. So the block propagation chart and transaction chart that he's referring to, they both are a 3-year time span, roughly, from July of 2015 to today. And to reach 50% of the network, it was originally averaging 8 to 10 seconds. And then there's a slow decline as we move forward, and it is almost appears to be under 1 second now to reach 50% of the network, whereas to reach 90% of the network, it started at around 20 seconds and has fallen to maybe 2, possibly 3, but is stabilizing very cleanly towards the very low end of time, which is a staggering drop in this chart for block propagation. Then the transaction delay chart for reaching 50% of the network, it dipped a little bit in early 2016, but has been steadily increasing. Went from about 2 seconds to reach 50% of the network to maybe around 5. And then throughout 2017, after July to today, it seems to be stabilizing right around 5 seconds. And to reach 90% of the network, it started out in early 2016 as low as 6 seconds, 7 seconds, and then has steadily increased into, again, July of 2017, and then finally starts to stable off, aside from a spike in December, and is leveling at about 14 seconds to reach 90% of the network. Bitcoin is designed with this in mind. The transaction count queue goes up, but the blocks are regulated. People end up learning how to use this tool we call a blockchain the right way over time, and transaction flow stabilizes. With an unregulated tool, you end up with a bunch of people chaotically trying to use that tool all at once for some random feature like CryptoKitties that ends up grinding the entire thing to a halt until the backlog is processed. All of the Ethereum full nodes need to process every single one of these contracts. You might not need to, and they might tell you that you don't need to, but someone does need to. So how many of them are there? What do higher fees do? They deter stupid dApps like CryptoKitties at the base layer. There is absolutely zero need for them, and larger, more functional ideas will only experience the same thing, but much worse, because blockchains don't scale. These dApps are crippling your blockchain because it's unregulated. And then there's an image of CryptoKitties, Pepe Farm, and then Ether Pokemon. But that was the promise, though, right? That was the dream. That was the entire premise of the Ethereum blockchain. Bitcoin, but better. It's not. Clearly, unregulated blocks don't result in infinite transactions, but the real takeaway here is the network can't even physically handle the current amount. There just aren't enough nodes capable of processing that information and relaying it in a timely fashion. Do you know how many Ethereum nodes there are? Do you really know? The Bitcoin network has about 115,000 nodes, of which about 12,000 are listening nodes. Almost all of them are participating nodes because that's regulated too. What a listening node is compared to a non-listening doesn't matter here because they are all participating in sending and receiving blocks to and from the peers they are connected to. The default is 8. The client won't even let you get more than 8 unless you add them manually. This was intentionally put in place, and it's recommended you don't add more because it's unhealthy for the network. Quote, Bitcoin by default will not make more than 8 outgoing connections, and dash max connections only controls how many incoming connections you allow. Feel free to set this higher, but it will take time before others connect to you in large numbers. Please don't change this, as there is no need. Connectable peers on the network are a scarce resource, and essential to the decentralization. If people go try to connect to all of them like some sites do, will very quickly run out. In case you're a merchant or miner, you perhaps want to set up a few fixed connections to trusted others. See the dash add node command line config option. But having more connections does not mean stronger verification. The reference client always verifies everything. Or even faster relaying, as you'll slow down by distributing new blocks and transactions to all of your peers. It is mostly a matter of providing a service to the network. End quote. And that was from Peter Wella on Bitcoin Stack Exchange. Remember this from earlier? Quote, this is the nature of P2P networking. You are at the mercy of the peers and network condition. Usually when you wait enough, it will work. Control-C and restart is fine too, which hopefully can get you a better peer. Another alternative is to find a good peer and add it manually. End quote. That's not how you fix things. This is a prime example of why a chain that allows participants the freedom to be selfish via lack of regulation is bad. This only has one outcome, master and slave nodes, where the limited masters serve all the slave nodes. Sounds decentralized, right? Especially when the financial requirements to be one of those master nodes keeps going up. To be fair, and as an aside, this is the exact criticism the Lightning Network gets, but it's a completely different type of network. Blockchain networks are peer-to-peer broadcast networks. State channel networks like Lightning are peer-to-peer anycast networks. The way information is being sent is completely different. Your refrigerator has enough hardware to be a Lightning node. Lightning, quote, hub-and-spoke criticisms are with channel balance volumes. Hub and spoke is equivalent to the master and slave issues, but with channel balances, there is no bottleneck on the data. You just standardize the Lightning clients to open X amount of channels with X amount of funds in each. Then the network forms around that standard, completely avoiding hubs or spokes, just like the Bitcoin clients standardize 8 peers. The Lightning Network is new, so we don't know what that standard should be yet, because we have almost zero data that we can measure. End Lightning defense. Speaking of zero data we can measure, why are these the only charts for Ethereum node counts? Where's the history? How many of these nodes used fast or warp sync and never fully validated it all? You don't need to store it all because you can prune, but again, how many are fully validated? How many are just light clients syncing only the block headers? The graphics shown are from ethernodes.org and suggest that there are around 10,000 clients on the network, but again, as mentioned, do not delineate between fully validating or fast sync nodes. It's funny how propaganda sites like Trust Nodes pushing Bcash conspiracies publish pieces like the following one with bold-faced lies. Then it gets circulated around and no one outside the flow of correct information questions it. Trust Nodes headline, quote, "Ethereum now has 3 times more nodes than Bitcoin," end quote. There are 115,000 Bitcoin nodes, and they all fully validate. So what do you do now? What do you do as an individual who slowly comes to this realization? What do you do as an individual who has no idea what's going on? What happens to a network that is primarily made up of these individuals that slowly leave? Not literally, but as a participating node downgrading to a light node. How many participating nodes are left? How many nodes hold a full copy of the original Genesis block? What happens when 5 data centers are serving the entire network of slaves, or light nodes, the chain? Who's validating those transactions when everyone is only syncing the block headers? You can sit there and repeat time and time again that the network only needs the recent state history to be secure all you want. But when your network is broken from the bottom up and most nodes can't even keep up with the last 1,000 blocks, how is that secure in any way? The takeaway from all of this. 1. Ethereum's block size growth is bad because of node processing requirements, not how much they need to store on a hard drive. 2. To prevent complete collapse of the network, Ethereum will need to implement a reasonable block size cap. 3. Implementing a block size cap will raise fees and in return prevent many dApps from functioning or severely slow down. Future dApps won't work. 4. If dApps don't work, Ethereum's entire proposition for existing is moot. Where does Bcash fit in? 1. Bcash just increased their block size from 8 megabytes to 32 megabytes, and is adding new opcodes soon to allow, quote, features like ICOs and Bcash birdies. Bcash has room to grow, coming from a completely understressed blockchain, while Ethereum is a completely overstressed blockchain. Ethereum is dying, and Bcash is trying to be exactly like it, while ignoring all the warning signs we've been trying to bring to everyone's attention. They wanted bigger blocks and ICOs. They got it now. Both chains will become the same thing. Centrally controlled blockchains that will slowly die, but given temporary life support via gradual block size increases to continue supporting fraudulent utility tokens until the entire system breaks down when no one can run a node. My suggestion: stop using centralized blockchains. Just for reference, there's an image here that's Vitalik at some sort of an Ethereum gathering, and it's the one where he's holding up the Ethereum artwork, the painting, and it's been replaced with the growth of the blockchain chart that was posted up earlier. But that's all we need for the reference. The only one in that room that runs a fully validating node is the one that's simultaneously holding up the painting and the Ethereum network. I've managed to make no mention of Vitalik this whole article, so I can focus on the technicalities. But if this picture, or the original, doesn't represent the essence of the Ethereum space, then I don't know what does. I applaud Vitalik for calling out scammers like Fake Satoshi, yet at the same time he equally misrepresents the functionality claims of Ethereum. Oh, and that golden goose egg you call sharding? It's hocus pocus. Fairy dust. It's the same node centralization issue with a veil thrown in front of it. It's effectively force-feeding you the master and slave network I just warned you about, under the disguise of new scaling tech. Forgetting Vitalik's diagram he put out because it's meaningless, let's try to simplify Ethereum's current network first. The diagram below essentially shows all the light clients in green and the, quote, good full nodes in red. Your fast or warp sync node may be red now until it can't, or you give up on upgrading and maintaining and just use the light client feature. Then it joins the green group. As time moves forward, the green nodes increase while the red decrease. This is inevitable because it's what everybody is already doing. Do you run a full node or a light client? Do you run anything at all? Switching to using the light client is consistently recommended, quote, if syncing fails. That's not a fix. This chart is really generous. Many full nodes, the red, actually have bad peers and connections. They're not this well connected. Don't worry though, Vitalik is here to save the day. He's turning nodes into SPV clients that only sync the block headers. Quote, the limit is basically that every node will have to verify the block headers of all the shards, and a node's capacity to do this is bounded above by their computational capabilities. Hence, quadratic sharding. If a node can process C things, then there's C shards for which the node can process block headers. Or if the node is verifying a single block, it could save up to C transactions. Here, C squared total capacity, or roughly. End quote. But what does that mean? Well, fortunately, I wasted a lot of time drawing this up too, so I can explain it visually. But first, let's start with words. In Bitcoin, you either fully validate or you don't. You're either a full node and do everything, you fully validate all transactions and blocks, or an SPV client that does nothing. It's just tethered to a full node, syncs just the block headers, and shares nothing. They are not part of the network. They shouldn't even be mentioned here, but I'm doing it to avoid confusion. Again, there are 115,000 Bitcoin full nodes that do everything. In Ethereum, there are full nodes that do everything. They fully validate all transactions and blocks. Nodes that try to do everything but can't sync up because of peer issues, so they skip the line and use warp or fast sync, and then, quote, fully validate new transactions and blocks. And then light nodes that are permanently syncing just the block headers, and I guess they are sharing the headers with other similar nodes, so let's call these SPV nodes. They don't exist in Bitcoin. Again, SPV clients in Bitcoin don't propagate information around, they are just nodes. That Ethereum node count? Guarantee you those are mostly light nodes doing absolutely zero validation work. Checking headers is not validation. You don't agree with that? Prove me wrong. Show me data. They are effectively operating a secondary network of just sharing the block headers, but fraudulently being included in the networked node count. They don't benefit the main network at all and just leech. In new Ethereum, with sharding, things change a bit. There are full nodes that do everything, they fully validate all transactions and blocks. Shard networks with full nodes that do everything within that shard and validate the headers of other shards. And then nodes that just sync, validate, and propagate the block headers of the different shards. Again, checking headers isn't validation. This is effectively a secondary network of non-nodes that are going to pretend they're real Ethereum nodes. And they're going to include it in the node count and continue tricking people into thinking this is a functioning, decentralized network when it's not. Take a wild guess which kind of node you'll be running. Go ahead, I'm waiting. Nothing has changed for the fully validating nodes at all. Nothing. I went ahead and cheated a bit with the connections using copy-paste. I'm not wasting that much time doing this for the sake of accuracy. The blue networks are the shard networks. The red network is the same old Ethereum network made up of nodes that still need to process everything. The green, quote, nodes are just syncing the headers and sharing them around. The graphic that he has here to show the sort of network layout, I encourage you to go look at it, but it's not going to do it any justice at all if I attempt to explain it in audio. So if you want to see the relationship there, I encourage you to go to the full article and check it out on his Medium page. This isn't scaling. When your node can't stay in sync, it downgrades to a light client. Now with sharding, it can downgrade to a, quote, shard node. None of this matters. You're still losing a full node every time one downgrades. What's even worse is they are calling all the green dots nodes, even though they are only syncing the headers and trusting the red nodes to validate. How would you even know how many fully validating nodes there are in this setup? You can't even tell now, because the only sites tracking it count the light clients in the total. How would you ever know that the full node's centralized to, let's say, 10 data centers? You'll never know. You will never know. On the other hand, Bitcoin is built from the ground up to prevent this. Quote, Bitcoin incentivizes the crowdsourcing of millions of private detectives to investigate people suspected of trying to undermine Bitcoin or co-opt Bitcoin. You don't want to be an enemy of Bitcoin, end quote. And that's by Kevin Pham, a Twitter post. So, what are you going to do? What should you do? Are you a developer? Take everything you've learned and start developing applications on top of a good blockchain, one that isn't broken. Are you a merchant? Start focusing on readying your services to support payment networks, ones that are built on top of a good blockchain. Are you an investor? Take everything you've invested and start investing in a good blockchain, one that isn't going to die in the coming years. Are you a gambler? Buy EOS. It's newer, just as shitty for all the same reasons I mentioned above, just no one knows it yet. Are you an idealist? This is definitely not the chain for you. Find one that is. If you're interested in running a Bitcoin node that will never go out of sync or demand that you update your hardware, check out this tutorial I put together. And that will conclude Stop and Decrypt's very thorough piece on the headaches and bottlenecks that the Ethereum network is running into. And it's interesting, I don't think I knew, because he's right and about the there being such a lack of data on this topic. And I didn't realize that it was a case of these, I mean, some of these block explorers no longer running full nodes or just going offline and shutting down. I literally just assumed I wasn't able to find, because there's so many block explorers for Bitcoin. It's like, I mean, I have a bookmark folder with probably 20 or so of them in there. So I just assumed that those were all out there for Ethereum and that I just didn't know where to look for the information. But according to Stop and Decrypt, it seems that the information's not even out there. You can't really find the data very well. And spinning up your own node to try to figure out some of the information is pretty hard in and of itself, it seems like. I mean, 1.1 terabytes. I had no idea. I actually read the article he references toward the beginning about Ethereum's block size will not be 1 terabyte anytime soon, which again was like 7 months ago or something that it was posted. And his argument made sense and it seemed like they were tapering for a little bit there, but then it just exploded from here. And I did not know until I saw Stop and Decrypt post this article that it had exceeded 1 terabyte. And it is in fact 1.1 if you look at the Geth database size. So that's pretty scary. That's a huge, huge amount of growth. And Someone posted, God, I wish I could find it now. I'm going to feel real stupid if I didn't save that somewhere. But it showed that there were only, that it was after like, I want to say it was like 20 or 30 nodes that everything below it in a list of IP addresses and nodes and where they were synced in the chain were not staying synced. And I may be wrong on that specific number, but it was a list, like it was a visible list, and it showed colors to show how close they were to the current block height in syncing. And it turned red relatively quickly from the green of everybody who was synced on the network. And so it couldn't have been a significant number if that data was correct. Unfortunately, I can't really vouch much for it because I don't have it on hand. I'm looking right now, but I don't seem to have it easily accessible. So if I find it, I'll try to add it to the Twitter post. And if anybody has any conflicting data or some article that details how this is supposed to be addressed, because this rate of growth, I mean, this pushes, I mean, in my mind, this makes it appear that Ethereum might not make it out of 2019 without a significant change to the underlying protocol. So, which may be as simple as a block size cap, but you're starting from 1.1 terabytes, so you're starting at a really bad place to have to set the beginning standard, I guess you could say. I mean, it's not like you can roll back 500 gigs to make this whole thing easier to handle. Like, I think the entire approach is really at risk here, which I always kind of felt like we were going to get to this point, even when I didn't understand it as clearly as I feel I do now. That's why some time back I invested a little bit in Stratus, because I wondered if there still was viability to this type of smart contract model, but just not on the base chain, whereas they're trying to take a modular approach. So like CryptoKitties would be its own side chain. So disclaimer, you know, I've got a little investment in Stratus, so, you know, I would benefit if they took off, but I'm still not 100% confident in their actual approach. I'm still very heavily on the side of Bitcoin will solve this problem with layers, but I'm still also very interested in seeing Stratus take the kind of differing approach that Ethereum is taking, just to see where it plays out. And not to mention, they're also doing a ton of work that is almost immediately compatible with the Bitcoin blockchain, and will apply. I mean, they're the ones working on the Tumblebit implementation, which was my original interest in the project. So it will be interesting to see what they come out and how they'll take this type of information into account. And I know there's a lot of other smart contract platforms that are trying to do stuff similar, but my focus usually isn't on altcoins in particular, and that's why Stratus kind of caught my attention, is because they're working on Bitcoin stuff too. So that's just a little aside about those guys, just because I think it's them as well as like something like Neo or Cardano or those like that are attempting to compete with the Ethereum platform. And I don't know much about any of those enough to kind of give any further details. But I do know Stratus relatively well, just because it's something to keep up with when you have a couple bucks on the line. But regardless, this development for Ethereum is going to be a very, very tough one to tackle. And I think it will be, I think this will have shockwaves throughout the entire altcoin industry for what happens with Ethereum, because it is almost the poster child for so many of these projects thinking that they are viable. So if Ethereum turns out to be not viable and trending towards an inevitable point, a tipping point where it can no longer maintain its own network without just turning into a centralized service essentially, that's going to spell disaster for a ton of altcoins, maybe even Stratus. I'm not 100% sure how well it applies to their approach. So we could see, keep in mind that if this turns ugly with Ethereum, we could see a very painful altcoin winter coming forward. And something like an altcoin winter could very easily result in the price spike of Bitcoin, because that capital flow may fall back into the safe bet in this space, because it's easier to get out of all those altcoins and into Bitcoin than it is to get back to dollars. A lot of these like altcoin and token crypto exchanges, a lot of them don't even have dollar pairs these days. They're all based on either Bitcoin or Ethereum. So this will be interesting to see this go forward, and it really kind of sucks that we don't have much data to keep an eye on this, and that the data is possibly going to get harder and harder to sort through, and the avenues for getting it are going to be harder because the network is so overstressed right now. I guess my best advice here is, Crayful gang, just be careful with your money. You don't want to get stuck in a network that cannot survive the coming year. There are going to be a lot of changes in this industry in the next year or two, and you want to protect yourself. So with that, we'll go ahead and close this here. Again, that was an article by Stop and Decrypt. You can find him at Stop and Decrypt, all spelled out, on Twitter. Same for his Medium page. He's got a lot of other great content and articles up there, so I definitely suggest staying with him. He's a very good resource for a lot of information. Also, follow me on Twitter at TheCryptoEconomy and Medium as well. And subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and don't forget to share it with all of your crypto friends so they too can hear all the best Bitcoin articles. This has been the Crypto Economy Podcast, and I'll catch you guys next time. Take it easy, everybody.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.